Welcome back to Creative Therapy Umbrella. This is a place where we talk about all different types of creative arts therapies, expressive therapies, and creative approaches to therapy. Today's episode is quite special, not that the other episodes aren't, but I get to speak with Dr. Linda Hawkins about gender development and identity. With the recent rollbacks in healthcare rights, new rules have erased explicit non-discrimination protections for the LGBT community, and healthcare providers are being sent the message that they can deny care to this community. Linda, who is the co-director of the Gender and Sexuality Development Clinic and a family services specialist, not only gives us an overview of gender development and identity, but she also discusses the important elements of supporting the LGBT community through direct client care, as well as through systemic advocacy. There are a ton of resources that Linda has given as well in this episode, and those are listed in the show notes, so don't forget to check those out. Thank you guys so much for listening and enjoy the episode. Okay, Linda, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kate.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure. I wish I was actually in Denver in person. It's one of my favorite places in the United States.
It is an amazingly beautiful place. I do love it here. Lots to do, that's for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, for our listeners, could you tell us a little bit about what you do in your practice?
Sure. So in my role at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, I have kind of two hats. My primary role is as the director of the Gender and Sexuality Development Program. And that program serves transgender, gender non-binary, and gender expansive children and youth and their families. It's a multidisciplinary clinic that includes mental health, adolescent medicine, endocrinology, nutrition, and many of the other subspecialties in the hospital. And we care for kiddos and their families through medical, social, legal, spiritual, and educational transition up to the age of about 21. The program has two clinics, one in Philadelphia and one in Voorhees, New Jersey. And so I'm the choreographer of fun in that role of meeting with families, identifying their needs, and then choreographing their care throughout their transition process. So my background is as I'm a licensed professional counselor, and I have a PhD in human sexuality and human development. So my specialty is LGBTQ children, youth, and families. So it's a nice pairing of my clinical skills and my research background in that role. Then my second role is within the larger hospital system. I oversee the LGBTQ patient and staff policies and practices. And I purposefully made my role have both of those hats involved, because in order for my clinic to really be successful and my patients to feel well protected and for trans staff to feel honored and respected, I need to be overseeing the institutional guidelines that make sure that that happens. Mm-hmm. So I'm not only focusing on the clinic itself and the care within the clinic, but also the larger climate of the institution as a whole to assure that it is as trans competent and trans affirming as possible. So that's me in a nutshell.
That is awesome. You've got a lot of different, I would imagine a lot of different hats that you get to wear in your work.
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes those hats are easy and sometimes they're hard, but nevertheless, I feel like having worked with other hospitals that have gender clinics, when they don't have that second hat of the climate and culture support, it doesn't go as well.
Mm-hmm. And that feels like even as therapists, a really important thing of the work we do in the therapy room is really important, but then also how we're advocates for our clients outside of that and making connections in the community, like that dual role of the internal and the systems.
Exactly. And that's actually the where the thought came from is, you know, we create great safe situations in our offices. And then, so yes, the exact mirror of that concept of, you know, then we step out of our office to then make a community or a system that will embrace the safety and adopt the safety that we've created. So that's exactly the systemic approach that I take.
Yeah, I love that. Can we break down those two things a little bit and talk about, let's dive into the supportive care in the, you know, the therapy room, the practice room. What are some things that are essential to providing that supportive care for our youth?
So when I first get a chance to meet with the family and, you know, assessing where everybody's at and then where we need to start our care, I really like to focus on the parents and the family structure, the family system, and then the school systems. Those are usually the first two. And then the third is the faith system, so spirituality. So starting with the parents or the caregivers, what we know from the research is that when young people have the support of a parent or a caregiver, their thoughts and attempts at self-harm significantly reduce. Our colleagues out in Seattle, Christine Olson and her research, longitudinal research with trans kids, has shown that when trans kids have parental support and affirmation, the rates of anxiety and depression and suicidality actually reduce to the same levels as non-transgender kids or cisgender kids experience in general. So that's a phenomenal thing for me to be able to share back with a parent as I'm helping them learn to embrace a child that they might not have known was right in front of them. Mm-hmm. And so it's really, that's where I do a lot of my support for the young person is actually directly into the parents. So when kiddos have parental support, their thoughts of suicide significantly reduce, and then having the young person connected to a medical clinic again significantly reduces it further. So when parents come to me, I tend to find that I put them into one of three categories, actually four categories. One is completely accepting, and those are the fun ones that are like a breath of fresh air. And nowadays there are many more parents who have knowledge about gender exploration and transgender identity, are open to it. And so I sometimes meet parents with, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds who from 2, 3 years old have been affirmed in their true gender identity. And what's fabulous is that, you know, we see kids who are just completely joyous and, you know, may have their own additional things going on, but really psychosocially, they're just really, really happy little people. So then the next category would be the three that then begin my more fervent work is parents who have a big head, a big heart, or a big challenge. So when a parent has, I categorize them as a big head, is that they've come in and they've read everything. They sometimes walk into my office with a stack of articles that are highlighted and they say, this is not my kid. I have read everything there is and I don't think my kid is trans and it's a phase. I'm not going to believe this. So once I understand that that's where a parent is coming from, I therapeutically lean into their heart. I need to activate their heart as it comes to their care for their child. So revisiting, you know, a time when the parent was more connected to their heart for their kid, their love for their kid, even going back to some of their dreams and hopes when they found out that they were going to be a parent for that child. Once I'm able to connect the parent back to their heart, it loosens up some of that headspace to take in some more new information. And then if somebody is, I realize that if a family coming in or a parent coming in is in the big heart space, they're coming in and they 9 times out of 10 have seen the statistics about self-harm and suicidal ideation, and they're terrified. And they'll say to me, Linda, I don't know what to do. I don't understand this, but I love my kids so much and I'm scared. So in those situations, my charge is then slowly and thoughtfully add knowledge so that they can learn to understand the child that they have in front of them. And then the last category is the big challenge. So these are parents who come in and their head is closed off and their heart is closed off. And those for me are the hardest and saddest families to start my work with, but it informs me about where I need to start. I need to open up their heart and their head to the idea of having a transgender child.
I love those. Framing the categories, framing, you know, having kind of a structure like that, that's so grounding and such a great way to connect with parents of when you know, you know, okay, if this is our barrier, how can we break through this? Kind of having that structure is so helpful.
Yeah, and you know, it can feel like you're juggling with Jell-O and when you're trying to figure out where to start any type of therapeutic work. And so I really feel like going back to some of our clinical, you know, underpinnings, frameworks, foundations, when I'm struggling and I don't know what to do next, it helps me prepare and to frame myself in a thoughtful manner. And also to be like, am I just winging this? And being able to say, no, there's a plan here.
Yes. Helpful to have that grounding.
Absolutely. And then, you know, the second two systemic areas that I mentioned after working with families, parents, and caregivers is then school. When I started the clinic at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in 2014, about 2/3 of the young people that I met were not in school because of bullying.
Wow.
So, you know, there's some kids who are introverted and just do much better through homeschool or online school, but the majority of the kids that I was talking to were home, not by choice, but because of significant anxiety and depression caused by bullying. So the next advocacy step that I found for supporting our transgender and gender non-binary children and youth was getting out into the schools and helping schools establish policies and practices and have trainings so that the bullying can stop. And what's been really fun to see is that more and more kids are back in school. And I would say now we're down to about, well, prior to COVID, only about 1/5 of our kids are now out of school because of feeling so anxious in the school space. So that's another place where the advocacy of getting out there and teaching and training schools and working with local educational organizations to pick up some of the training needs has also been really helpful. And the third space is faith. You know, there's, I think, a misunderstanding or a hypothesis, an urban myth, if you will, that, you know, people in the LGBT community typically will step away from faith or church or their belief in order to balance their sexual orientation or their gender identity. And that's really a shortcoming and a minimization of the importance of faith and spirituality for children, youth, and their parents and families. And so that other systemic area where we work really hard to create the equally safe environment as we create in our clinical office is to go into the churches and do similar education, oftentimes with families side by side, to help churches and synagogues to create not only a non-discriminatory type of faith practice, but also an inviting and welcoming type of faith practice that is purposeful in their inclusion of transgender people. Mm-hmm.
And that seems like those within the family, the school, and the spiritual, long processes. It seems like it would be long processes to make some of those changes happen.
It is, and it's one of those culture changes that doesn't happen overnight, and it's a culture change that requires continual feeding and nurturing. So that's also where, when I work with therapists in the community, I try to let them know they don't have to do this all themselves, and becoming parts of coalitions where you're partnering your expertise and your clinical skills and in your patient and family skills with other people who can also partner to further the climate changes in families and schools and organizations and faith homes. You don't have to do it all yourself.
Yes, we can definitely feel that weight sometimes of how do we tackle this? But knowing that there's a much larger community out there to do it with is so helpful.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about how some of this policy also affects hospitals and healthcare, what those things kind of look like, and if there's anything as therapists we can do to support our clients with their the process that they go through in healthcare and the barriers they go through?
Yeah, so it's interesting because you're in Denver, and I'm in Philadelphia, and so and unfortunately the timeliness of this conversation is pretty powerful considering the information that came out of DC on Friday with the efforts to roll back the non-discrimination protection of Act 1557. So I feel like with therapists finding out how to be the best advocates for their clients, as well as keep in mind what a client or a patient or might be coming into your office with as far as distress or worry, I really encourage therapists to find some sort of news outlet or governing organization that can get you the topics in a way that feels digestible and also prioritizes some of your patient populations, especially with what's happening ever so quickly within policy changes. So when it comes to following the late and breaking news, both positive and challenging, for transgender folks of any age, so not just pediatric patients, is the National Center for Transgender Equality, so NCTE.org. That is an organization also out of Washington, D.C., that manages transgender policies and reviews transgender politics for the entire nation. So if you have listeners who are in Colorado or in other states, they can go to this site and they have state-by-state breakdowns of what's going to be important for you to know when it comes to healthcare policy, education policy in your state. So that's a really, I find that to be a really helpful resource so that I'm not combing the news to see who I'm supposed to be listening to and how to interpret what's coming out.
Yes.
And then, the way I put that into practice in my sessions, and I've been doing it all this week, is, you know, at the warm-up of a session and checking in to see how folks are doing, if a family doesn't say, I'm really worried about what's coming out of DC during their check-in at the beginning of the session, I'll specifically ask, I'll say, did you hear about the news that came out last Friday? Do you have any questions or concerns about it? Because I feel like it's important to put it in the room, especially since the information on Friday about Act 1557 has to do with healthcare. Mm-hmm. That also gives me a chance to put it in the room and say, I'm not afraid to talk about this. Mm-hmm. And if they say that they aren't aware of it, or they are aware of it, being able to say explicitly, I want you to know that the hospital system and all of our care providers and affiliates will never change their stance on non-discrimination. We will forever take care of you and your families, and we will do that in opposition of anybody who tells us otherwise. So being able to put that confidence out there, whether it's stated as a worry or not. Mm-hmm. So those are some ways that we're bringing that into practice. One of the nice things that we've been able to do with the recent switch to telehealth is actually reach families further away from the hospital, saving families trips into the hospital and even into the clinic via telehealth. So that was a nice policy that got shifted very quickly for us to be able to do telehealth. I know in Colorado, you all have had provisions to offer telehealth for quite some time, but in Pennsylvania, we didn't have that provision.
That's exciting. Do you think that will continue past COVID or extend itself past that?
We are hoping. A couple folks in the hospital started a really rapid quality improvement and quality assurance study on telehealth to document the benefits, so that when the insurance companies and the licensing bureaus say that they want to be done with our emergency licensing to do this work and the emergency funds to this work, that we'll be able to continue in some shape or form.
Oh, I love that. It's so exciting to see that with this change that we were kind of talking a little bit off air about it, that there's been so many benefits as well of the changes in telehealth and how we can reach more people and reach people differently and how supportive that can be.
Yeah, it's important for at least my soul to have to try to find some silver linings every day. Yeah. And I'm highlighting that is a silver lining for sure.
Yeah. Something that pops in my mind is rural access to even therapy in general and larger hospital organizations is really difficult. And I think something like this, the change in telehealth, is really exciting in that realm, in that your location won't be a barrier. It doesn't have to be a barrier.
Yeah, and I know for your area, you know, being able to have clinicians who can do telehealth to you know, your my friends over at Denver Children's Hospital talk about how they reach out to almost five states in your vicinity. So that's really phenomenal, and we were able to meet with families that would have spent easily 4 hours in the car each way to get to our hospital. So just the amount of emotional energy, financial energy that we're saving for families is a definite silver lining of all this.
Yeah, yes. And if we can take one barrier away, that's a good day.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about, can we dive into gender development in itself a little bit about when gender identity might solidify, or when, you know, some of those things might happen along the development of children, tweens, teens, and young adults?
Sure. So for many of the folks listening, you definitely had an exam on this at some point, and then we passed the exam, we got our licenses, and then we move on. So this will be the refresher course.
Yes.
Dust off that knowledge. So what we know from literature and research is that gender identity development is very much happening in childhood. And between the ages of 1 and 2, and then moving into 3 years old, children are absorbing and processing thousands of cues every day about gender, from the color of clothes that they're put in, from the messages that they're given from cartoons and books and multiple places. And so, you know, I like to kind of conceptualize it as little ones are walking around with like 2 post-its in their head when it comes to gender. And on one post-it, it says boy, and on the other post-it, it says girl. And as little ones are taking in all of this information about what's a girl and what's a boy, they're putting these facts or these little factoids onto those individual post-it notes. So what that could look like is, you know, Joey is being instructed about boy rules. So boys like blue, boys like kicking balls, boys like rough and tumble, boys are like dad who has a beard. And so that post-it of boy has blue, has ball, has kick, has beard, has dad. So all of those words go onto that post-it. And then for Janie, taking in all of those cues about what girlness is, she starts putting those items onto her girl post-it, and vice versa. So when Janie says, you know, I want to play with the fire truck, depending on the family, they might say, oh, that's fine. Or they might say, oh, fire trucks are what boys play with. Here, Janie, here's a doll. So I'm exaggerating a little bit, but in some families, the gender expectation and the gender rules are overt, and sometimes they're covert. But again, those little ones are populating those post-it notes pretty adamantly. And we know that because by age 3, given the opportunity for healthy development otherwise, we start to hear what's been percolating in those little heads. And we hear Janie say, I'm a girl, mommy's a girl. And maybe if there's a pet that has a pink collar, you know, Kitty's a girl. And equally, there's the same comments going on from, you know, little Joey. And in our language-rich society, that's where at 3, little ones start to get affirmations or confirmation that they're right, as well as correction. So when Janie says, I'm a girl, adults around will say, yes, Janie, you're a girl. You like pink, you have beautiful long hair, and you're going to be a princess someday. So there's that tone of affirmation. Mm-hmm. What that does for Janie is really solidify what's on her post-it note. And then there's the corrective comments when, let's say, Joey says, I'm a girl. I like dolls. I like princesses. And depending on the family or the school or the church or the daycare, Joey might hear, sure, that's fine, Joey. You can be whoever you want to be. Or you can like whatever you want to like. Or in our family, colors don't have genders and toys don't belong to boys or girls. They belong to everyone. That would be a confirmation. In some families, Joey might hear, boys don't like dolls, stop that. Or don't be a sissy. So then Joey's gonna look at that post-it note in his head and say, wait a second. Okay, dolls are not on the boy Post-it, they're on the girl Post-it. So what we then know after age three is starting age four through six is really where young people start to confirm and understand whether or not they fit with what's on that Post-it or they don't. So the youngest kiddos who I've met with in my clinic are sometimes as young as 4 and 5 years old. And those families tend to come via their pediatrician, where a parent will take their kiddo into the office and say, Joey keeps saying he's a girl and he's fighting us when we take him for a haircut. And he says that his name is Julia and he only wants to be called Julia. And now he's not sleeping well and he's crying all the time. Those are examples of, wow, this is a kid who really has a strong understanding of who they are. And I always like to frame this into kind of the larger gender development process, which is that it's completely natural and fairly typical for kiddos in that five-year-old range to explore gender and to try on different things. So when I taught preschool when I lived in Seattle, one of my favorite jobs ever, it was really fun to watch the 4 and 5 year olds trying on gender and in creative play, having Janie be dad and put on, you know, a suit and a tie during the dress up area, and then having Joey put on a dress and say, I'm gonna be mommy today. And so while that is a very, very typical part of gender development and gender play and gender exploration for the majority of children, the majority of children do not continue on with a level of persistence and insistence and consistence and equally have ongoing distress when they keep butting up against the gender rules or expectations that don't fit them. So many folks will say, okay, so for somebody to be transgender, they have to have known themselves within this time and frame context. So only kids who come out as trans at 4 and 5 are really transgender. And that's actually not the case. Probably about 50% of my my patients and clients did have some realizations as young as 4, 5, 6 years old that they are transgender. However, there's a whole other category of folks who come to this understanding later in life. And those later times in life can be during puberty, where body changes start to happen and the level of distress and duress really starts to spike. And there might then be a new clarification around the feelings that might have happened earlier in life that they weren't quite aware of or maybe didn't know how to categorize as actually identifying and feeling transgender. And then there are the kiddos who back at 4 and 5 learn the messages on the Post-its and know exactly who they are, and they also know that it's not going to be okay in their family. So those are often young people who come out and share with us about their gender identity later on in life. I always think of geography as a big variable in knowledge and understanding. So I was talking with a family yesterday, and this was a young person who was assigned male at birth who identifies as female. And even living in Philadelphia, where we think there, you know, I always think, oh, there's so much information all over the place in Philadelphia in support of transgender people. But this young person, living in Philadelphia, was somewhat sheltered when it came to media and information, and didn't realize that the thoughts and feelings she was having were really linking her to being a transgender person until she was in 9th grade, and had the pleasure of working with a counselor who helped her really dive into her anxiety and her depression about her body, and helped her really understand that anxiety and depression was because she really isn't a boy, that her distress with her body is because she's a transgender girl.
Wow. How amazing that she was able to finally get that, and how frustrating that she couldn't have access to that care earlier. It does make me wonder about how development and identity, how that looks across age development with anxiety and depression in this ninth grader. Does that look different for, let's say, someone in preschool or?
It can. And that's actually a great, I'm glad you framed that question this way so we can add this to our time together, which is that oftentimes, well, I would say the majority of us as clinicians didn't have a class on gender identity development. We might have passed a test on Erickson, but we didn't really get a full lesson on proactive therapeutic techniques for supporting LGBTQ clients. Unless you decided to do that as an elective, you probably didn't have a lot on that. And so what we end up having is situations where we kind of wait for our clients to bring up sexuality and gender. Mm-hmm. And I really am encouraging clinicians to bring it up first. Open the door and start asking the questions about gender and sexuality so that our clients know that we're open to talking about it and hearing about it, as well as creating a space of discussion and exploration. So for little ones, I really encourage clinicians to start to add different questions and prompting language into their therapeutic work, either during intakes or early on in their work, especially if there's anxiety or depression with their clients. And some of that language can sound like, so Janie, tell me how it feels for you to be a girl. Your parents were told that they had a baby girl when they were born. You've learned a lot about what it means to be a girl. How does that feel for you? Are there things that feel right about that? Are there things that feel not so right about that? Not everybody feels really great about their gender. Let's talk about what feels good for you. So using that language as a kind of a clinical prompt can be really helpful. And when I've used that with colleagues and gotten feedback on how that's gone, it can be really helpful not only to open the door for Janie to say, wow, I didn't know it could feel wrong for other people. It actually feels wrong for me. And I've always felt that I'm a boy. So bam, wow, that is stellar information to have gotten. As well as for cisgender kids who are just experiencing maybe their own sense of difference from the other girls in their family. So Janie might respond with, I'm okay being a girl, but I feel like all the girls in sixth grade are different than me. Or Joey being able to say, I feel like my dad doesn't like the kind of boy I am because I don't want to play sports like my older brothers. So it really opens up an important discussion, no matter what, no matter how somebody might identify, it opens up a good discussion for us clinically to explore. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes. And I love the phrase, let's talk about what feels good for you, because it's so affirming, but it's so open to there's so much to explore in that statement in itself.
Absolutely. It's general enough that it can create some really exciting conversations about, gender-based hopes and dreams and also just questions and curiosities. I find with my tweens or my preteens, having those conversations and that can lead into a lot of great questions. Like, is it normal that I fill in the blank, and the getting some of those really good conversations going, and also opening up the door around sexuality as well. Instead of waiting for a client to bring up that they're having discomfort with sexual activity or sexual thoughts and feelings, putting that overtly into the conversation. What's feeling really right in your heart and in your head when you think about people you have crushes on? Are there people that you're having crushes on or feeling romantic about? And tell me about those thoughts and those people. So again, opening up the conversations lets our clients know that they're safe to have with us.
Yes. I love how just putting it out there first is that affirming process of it's okay to talk about it and I'm not afraid to talk about it. So it's here if you need to.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love that. Are there for any of our listeners who are looking for more resources, whether it's specifically about gender and healthcare and how what that might look like? I know you mentioned the National Center, the NCTE, but any type of other resources, whether it's training, books, websites that would be helpful for our listeners?
Yeah, so locally you have a wonderful resource right there at Denver Children's Hospital. You have a gender clinic run by some really wonderful colleagues of mine. I'm biased because several of them trained in Philadelphia with me.
So awesome.
So you have a wonderful local resource in that. Mm-hmm. And then I would say that the as far as an online resource, the UCLA Medical Center, if you go to the UCLA Medical Center website and Google transgender, they have a really robust online presence that includes lots of the medical policies, and they keep that very up to date, which is really wonderful. Also, if you go to my website at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Gender and Sexuality Development Clinic, we have a page that's just resources, and those can be for clinicians. We have some training videos, and we also have reading lists for books for professionals, for parents, for teens, in addition that are specific to gender, but also around sexuality as well.
That is awesome. I will make sure to put links to all of those, especially I'll link separately to that resource list because that I'm excited to look through that. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, and it's great. Just preserving the energy of all of the clinicians who are out there, especially in private practice where you're doing everything yourself. Mm-hmm. Finding those websites that have other people's job to keep them updated so that you're not having to assure that things are updated. You just go there as well as send families there to do some of their additional homework. And I just thought of another wonderful resource, genderspectrum.org. That is a wonderful site that has everything under in one spot. So they have resources around education, faith, healthcare, family work, all sorts of stuff. And right now I know they have transferred many of their support groups to online groups, which is a great thing to take advantage of from afar. So taking a look at that site and even putting yourself on their email list to get updates is another great way of staying really, really present and up to date on all the resources that are out there. And as another plug, they host probably one of the best gender conferences every year that I go to, and it's out in California, but this year because of COVID, it's going to be an online conference on July 16th. So if you go to genderspectrum.org, you'll see information about that conference. Mm-hmm. And it's the lineup is pretty spectacular, and I'm not just saying that because I'm one of the speakers. But what I think is really cool is that so if you register, you will have access to not only be present live during the conference day, but you also will have access to all of the filmed presentations for 3 months.
Oh,
So for many of us who are spending way too much time on the computer, the idea of attending a full day conference can be very visually and psychologically daunting, but the fact that they are making it so that with your registration, you have access to all of the information for 3 months means you can really watch a session a week or take it in really slowly in edible portions. So it's a really wonderful conference.
That is awesome. That is another one of those silver linings, I think, of COVID, is how accessible conferences have been. You don't have to go. They seem a lot more cheap now too. There's, with online, it's so much more accessible. So it's not as expensive. That is awesome.
Yeah, those are some great resources. And I'll make sure that you have all of the right links to.
Wonderful. Yes. And I love the 3 months having access to a conference for that long. I always like to go back, even if I've sat there and I've been present, but then you have additional questions and you can go back and listen to it again for, you know, particular sessions. And it's always nice to have that extra time to take everything in.
Yeah. Yeah, I as soon as I saw that this week on their website, I was like, that is brilliant.
Yes, I love that. Awesome. Well, Linda, thank you so much for taking the time today to share your passions and your knowledge with us. This has been amazing.
Thank you. And thanks to all of the therapists who are listening for all the great work that they do every day.
Yes, awesome. All right, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode and found it informative. It was so lovely talking with Linda and her training program that she actually didn't mention in the podcast, but she talked to me a little bit off air about. Sounds amazing. And there is a link to that in the show notes for anyone who's looking to get more information on this topic. I think it's something every therapist could use if they haven't been able to access this information and get additional training on it. And this feels like a very important conversation that as therapists we need to be having with our clients and our clients' parents, especially with the recent changes. So I hope that this was helpful and informative for everyone. Also, just a reminder, there is the anonymous survey in our show notes, and that is for you to voice any concerns, feedback, requests that you might have for us at Creative Therapy Umbrella. Please let us know if we're missing something, if you want us to cover a topic that we have not covered. We really want to hear your voice. And also there is a link to our newsletter if you want to get additional content such as the stuff that's in this episode and in the podcast sent directly to your email. Thank you again so much for listening, and be creative.